Okay, welcome in everybody to episode 9 of the Beast Lord Podcast, a podcast about cryptid creatures, monsters, and the things that may or may not be hiding in the shadows. I'm your host, Jack Daly. Today we are going to be taking a journey through time and space to the planet Nibiru, where according to some theorists such as Zachariah Sitchin, a race of beings called the Anunnaki came to Earth hundreds of thousands of years ago. These alien overlords, according to Sitchinites, literally created humans and instructed us in the ways of science, math, religion, and civilization. Before I start the episode proper, I want to offer the following disclaimer. What I am about to say is very controversial. I do not personally believe that the Anunnaki theory or ancient alien theory is correct, but I still think it is worthy to be covered. The stories of the Anunnaki come from the translations of Sumerian tablets by the researcher Zachariah Sitchin. He took the tablets as being a literal truth. I tend to interpret them as more of a recording of cosmological principles, and perhaps as an example of early astrotheology. There was a time where I subscribed to some of Sitchin's theories, but those days have come and gone. Still, it is very interesting, and I think you will benefit from exposure to it. So basically what I'm going to do is I'm just going to tell you a story. And this story is basically about the Anunnaki and their travels from Nibiru to Earth and basically all of the things that they did. And you'll come to see that it ties into many of the ancient religions and many of the ancient civilizations of Earth. So again, once again, just try and suspend your disbelief as much as you can and just listen to what I have to say. And most of this comes from Zachariah Sitchin and the many books that he's written about his translations of the Sumerian tablets. So 500,000 years ago, the planet Nibiru began to experience a disruption in its atmosphere. And much of Anunnaki theory rests upon the existence of Nibiru. This planet is supposedly in our own solar system, and it is said to be one with an extremely elliptical orbit. And so an elliptical orbit is one that is, takes a long time to travel around the sun. Most of the planets like Earth have a far less elliptical path. It still is elliptical, but it's more circular than elliptical. And, elliptical is basically like ovular, it's not as purely round as a circle is, it's more long. So, the Anunnaki theory says that Nibiru is a planet that is in our own solar system. And Caltech researchers have actually found mathematical evidence of a planet that is far out in the solar system, and they call it Planet X. And a lot of people think that Planet X actually is Nibiru. So basically, back in 500,000 years ago when they started experiencing this disruption in the atmosphere, they decided that there would be a male leader from the north that would marry a female leader from the south to achieve peace. And these are the Nephilim, who are also known as the Anunnaki. So the Nephilim and the Anunnaki are the same thing. And the Nephilim, if you're familiar with the Bible, you'll know that the Nephilim are actually in the Bible. And basically the Anunnaki are a very specific sect of the Nephilim. And we'll come to see that. I'll go through, what the word Anunnaki means and how they are related to the Nephilim. But that's what they are. The Nephilim are these beings from Nibiru. And there's a lot of disagreement about who the Nephilim are or like what they look like. Some people say that they are bird-headed. If you look at, Sumerian depictions of these Anunnaki, they're bird-headed and they have wings. But sometimes they also have the face of a human and they're always very tall. They're basically gigantic, about 12 to 15 feet tall. Some people say that they are reptilians. Some say that they're shapeshifters. And as you'll possibly know if you've listened to my Bigfoot episode, people think that the Nephilim and Bigfoot are also linked. But they found these clay figurines in Sumeria that date back to, you know, thousands of years ago. And they're depictions of these reptilian creatures. And basically, archaeologists think that they are not supposed to be things that the common folk would have been able to see. It was specifically held for the elite. And these reptilian creatures, you know, you should look up what these are. Just type in reptilian Sumerian clay figurines and you should be able to find them. They are often breastfeeding, like holding babies, and that iconography is a singular instance. Like, you don't see reptiles and snakes being depicted as actually like breastfeeding babies, and they're anthropomorphic. They have arms and legs and they look like humans. So anyway, basically I'm going to go down through like the bloodline that passed through from this first marriage between the North leader and the South leader, and it'll kind of seem a lot like, again, if you've taken a look at the Bible, and especially in the Old Testament, the obsession with you know, the bloodlines and tracing you know, who was born from who. It might sound a little bit like that, but there's a point of the bloodline that I'm trying to get, so I'm going to give you an idea. And I think you could probably find this bloodline traced out online. If not, it might help to, I don't know, write it down or something like that. But try and track it as good as you can. So in the beginning, On married Onto, and their first male born would end up being the leader of a united Nibiru. So they had a patriarchal succession, basically. And then On and Onto gave birth to Anki. And then Anki ended up dying without an heir, so his youngest brother Anib took over. Anib became betrothed to Nidib, and they gave birth to a son named Anshargal. And then Anshargal married Kishargal, and they gave birth to Anshar. Anshar married Kishar, and they gave birth to Enshar. Enshar married Ninshar, and they gave birth to Duru. And then Duru married Duaru, and who was not of royal lineage. Daru was not from royal lineage, and they ended up adopting a child that they found at the palace gate. And this break of succession threw the court into confusion, and the son that they found, Lama, took the throne, and he took as his spouse Lahama. So during the reign of Anshar, a couple of lines ago, Nibiru's volcanoes, which had sustained the atmosphere, were not as active anymore. And as a result, the atmosphere began to tear. And this continued through Anshar's reign and through Duru's into Lama's. So this was a big deal. You know, their planet was having basically an environmental catastrophe, like we're having on Earth right now, but nobody's paying attention to it. And, you know, it threw the court into disarray. And basically, you know, two suggestions were put forth. They said, one, either we can use weapons of terror to make the volcanoes active again, or we can patch the breach with the dust of pulverized gold. And that's a kind of a key point. Apparently, I'm not exactly sure how pulverized gold was able to patch the breach, but that was very, very important to them. But they didn't have all of the gold necessary to do that. And Lama, who was, you know, he was the ruler, he couldn't decide what to do. And there ended up being a rebellion that was led by Alalu, and he had descended through the line of Anshargal by way of his son Alam, whose mother was a concubine. So Alalu broke into the palace and pushed Lama off the palace tower, where he fell to his death. And then Alalu became the ruler. And then an individual named Anu appeared before the council of the seven who judge and declares that he, not Alalu, should be the ruler. Anu was able to trace his line to An through Anib. And what the Council of Seven decided was that Alulu would remain the ruler, but upon his death, Anu would become ruler and his children would become the kings. So Anu accepted this and served as the cupbearer, but he wasn't satisfied. And after 9 Shars, which are the Nibiru years, and basically, apparently 1 Shar is equal to 3,600 Earth years, and that's another important point that I'll come back to later on, Anu rose up against Alulu, and they had a wrestling match, and Anu was victorious. But Alulu escaped, and he stole a spaceship, and he headed away from Nibiru. And his destination was set for Ki, which is now known as Earth. It was not his intention, but Alulu ended up finding gold on Earth that could be used to repair Nibiru's atmosphere. So that's how the story goes, is that Alulu ended up escaping from Nibiru. He came to Earth and he found gold there that he could use to repair Nibiru's atmosphere. And this was sometime around 500,000 to 450,000 years ago. And then 445,000 years ago, Anu authorizes his son, Ea, to travel to Earth with a group of 50 Nephilim to verify Alulu's claim. And these 50 that came to Earth are the ones that were given the name the Anunnaki. And that means those who from heaven to Earth came down. And, you know, probably most of these names are going to basically mean nothing to you if you're unfamiliar with this subject. If you research the Anunnaki, you know who the major players are, but I'm going to highlight a few of these names because they're going to be very important. A lot of the names I said at the start are going to be insignificant for the rest of today's episode, but you're going to have to know Anu. Anu is the ruler of Nibiru. Ea is one of his sons, and I'm eventually going to introduce another character named Enlil, who is another one of the sons of Anu and the brother to Ea. So, and that's the difference between the Nephilim, who are the beings from Nibiru, and the Anunnaki, who are basically the people who came, or the Nephilim that came to Earth. And so within 6 days of them arriving on Earth, they settled at Eridu in the region named Eden. So that's another thing that's going to play a part, is a lot of this has a lot of similarities to the Garden of Eden story and basically the Bible itself. And it's going to get really weird. So I'll just warn you of that right now. And Eridu was in Mesopotamia, which is modern day Iraq. And a lot of this story kind of takes place in the Fertile Crescent, which is, again, I don't think a mistake, because the Fertile Crescent is that area. It's shaped like a crescent, but it was like basically Egypt up through the Tigris and Euphrates River, which is Mesopotamia. And that's where civilization began. That's where the domestication of livestock began. That's where Mesopotamia was. It's a very important place in archaeology, basically in the history of Earth. And so they get there and they start to mine for gold, and they end up finding some. And they took Alulu's spacecraft and they found forbidden weapons there. They took the weapons and they hid them, and the tests on the gold succeeded. It actually was working to help patch their atmosphere. So that was basically their goal here, was to mine the gold so that they could repair their atmosphere. And it's also very possible that the Hebrew tradition of the 6 days of creation may have derived from the Sumerian account of the Anunnaki landing. Their account takes note of certain tasks being done on certain days, the recording of trees, recording creatures, etc. And apparently on the seventh day, Ea proclaimed that the seventh day would be home of rest. And Eden means home of the righteous ones. Eridu means earth. And like I said, Eden is in the land between the Tigris and the Euphrates in the Fertile Crescent. So then 440,000 years ago, the Earth settlement must be expanded is what the Nibiru individuals decided. They're like, all right, we need to expand this more. And Enlil and Anu travel from Nibiru to Earth to see if the gold retrieval process can be accelerated. Like I said, Enlil is the brother to Ea, and I'll get to this when it comes, but Ea also is going to be known as Enki. So Enki, Ea, and Enlil. And Enki actually means snake, which is an interesting thing. That's to do with the Garden of Eden. And the whole snake motif in this story is very, very perplexing. And I'll get more into that later. But there's also that aspect of it. So at this point, when Anu and Enlil came, all of the gold that was being retrieved had come from the ocean. And Ea ended up traveling in a sky chamber to search for gold. So that's what it's called, as a sky chamber, but it was obviously a spacecraft they took. And he ended up finding some gold in Africa along the Zambezi River. And it's interesting because ancient gold mines have been found there. It's not clear, you know, I'm not exactly sure how old they are. They're definitely not 440,000 years old, I don't think. But it's interesting that there is gold mines that are found there. And Enlil was directed by his father to see why Ea was taking so long. Ea said that it was very difficult, and they discussed who should command Eridu, the Eridu settlement, and who should oversee the gold mining operation that was taking place in Africa. And they asked their father to decide because they couldn't, and Anu said that they should draw lots. And when they drew lots, Anu was chosen to remain the king. Enlil becomes lord of the command of Eridu, and Ea was to become the Enki, which is the Earth's master, also known as the gold miner extraordinaire, is what you can think of it as. But that's when Ea also becomes Enki, the Earth's master. And to oversee the mining of gold, Enki Ea built his home. And the stuff I was reading says that his home that he built was the Great Zimbabwe, which is, an archaeological site in Zimbabwe, but apparently that dates to the Iron Age. So, once again, the timing of Sitchin's, you know, claims doesn't match up with the real archaeology, to my knowledge at least. And Alulu was mad that he was not part of the drawing of the lots, and he challenged Anu, and Anu beats him. But Alulu ended up biting off Anu's thing, his man part, and Anu returned to Nibiru to heal. And Alulu ends up being exiled, and he's exiled to life on Mars. And apparently that's what they say. And his grandson, Anzu, ends up going and stays with him there. And then we'll skip ahead to 415,000 years ago when Ninhursag traveled to Earth from Nibiru. And she was basically the chief medical officer, but on her way to Earth, she stopped at Mars and she found Alulu dead. And she found a rock carved there that resembles his face. And, you know, it's interesting, on, the Cydonia region of Mars, there actually is stuff that looks like there's faces. But I think that that's probably another instance of pareidolia, which is, you know, seeing faces in nature. And I don't know, you can find some pretty interesting stuff about, like, the faces on Mars and the Cydonia region. People will, like, use geometry to connect, like, specific sites of it and say, okay, this is exhibiting, like, this mathematical constant or whatever. Which makes it pretty perplexing, but I don't know what to make of it. I don't know what to make of any of this, to be quite honest with you. But anyway, if you haven't looked up the face on Mars, look that up, but that's apparently the face of Alulu. And then Anzu is given the command of Mars, and Ninhursag ends up coming to Earth, and she and Enlil have a son named Ninurta. And by 400,000 years ago, they had set up a complex site of a complex of 8 cities that were established, and a city named Nippur was the mission control center. By 360,000 years ago, they had Shurupak, which was the medical center, Bad Tapira, which was the industrial center that they used for smelting and refining gold, and they also had Larsa and Lagash, which was their beacon cities. Skipping ahead to 320,000 years ago, Enlil ends up getting exiled for rape, and he learns of the hidden weapons that they took from Aalu. And Sud becomes Enlil's spouse, and they have a son named Nannar. And Enki has daughters with Ninma in Africa, and Enki Ea's son is named Marduk. And Marduk is going to be end up being a big player in this. I just wanted to give you an idea of, you know, the line that's going to be coming up from Enlil and Enki Ea. Enlil has progeny, like he has sons, but it's really Enki Ea's sons that are the big players. Sorry, I meant to say Enlil is the one who has sons that are not as significant, and Enki Ea is the one that ends up having a lot of sons that you're probably going to be familiar with. Marduk is one of them. And 300,000 years ago, the Anunnaki, who have been delegated to the mine in Africa, in Abzu, stage a rebellion. And Aalu's grandson, Anzu, attempts to seize mastery over the earth. And the Enlilites win this war, which is called the War of the Olden Gods. And then Enki and Ninhursag contrive to create an alternative being to take over the tedious labor of the Anunnaki. So this is a big turning point in the story, and could be the most controversial aspect of Anunnaki theory. At this point in time, there is no human beings. There is no Homo sapiens sapiens. So basically, they come up with an idea to basically make a primitive worker that could bear their work. And they say that there's a being on Earth that could be upgraded with the image of the Anunnaki. And Enlil ends up disapproving, and he says that the creation in general, like, you know, cosmic creation, belongs to the Father of all being. And it's interesting, when you're reading this stuff, they'll say, people will be like, okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself there for a second. I don't want to go into that digression quite yet, but anyway, they decided to create primitive workers, and Enki sets out to find the primitive wild man that roamed the Abzu. And Enki ends up finding these wild men, and with the help of his son at Ningish Zeta, perform tests on them. And these wild men are Homo erectus, and it's said that they make Homo sapiens sapiens out of the Homo erectus to be their slaves to mine gold from them. So, yeah, that's how Anunnaki theory goes, is that human beings were the ones that we were created, apparently, according to Zachariah Sitchin. And again, I'm not endorsing this theory. I want to be very clear about that we were made to be slaves that mined gold for aliens. But anyway, the digression I was going to get into is, people will be like, okay, so if the Anunnaki made humans, who made the Anunnaki? The creator of the entire universe. That's who created them. That's what the answer is to that. But I always find that that's a funny thing that comes up when people that aren't quite on that wavelength will ask that question. But it's obvious what it is. But getting back to Ningish Zeta being the one that performed the tests on the Homo erectus, is that Ningish Zeta, according to stuff that I've been reading, because this Ningish Zeta ties into my thesis work, and he was originally identified with the Caduceus, which is the serpent entwined staff of Hermes. Ningish Zeta apparently was like, actually identified with the Caduceus. The Caduceus was the god, and the god was Ningish Zeta. And this is according to actual, you know, anthropologists. And the crazy part about that is that I think that the Caduceus, the serpent entwined staff, is, you know, it has to do with DNA. And it was also this DNA of the Anunnaki that they ended up basically using to create the Homo sapiens. And so I don't quite know what to make of it, but there's something there. And yeah, eventually they succeed, and the Homo sapiens sapiens are made by genetically altering Homo erectus beings. And the first Homo sapiens sapien that they made was called Adamu, which is very, very similar to Adam. So, like, here's basically the Adam and Eve story. The Adamu was brought into existence by infusing Nephilim DNA into the Homo erectus. And it's also said that they got the DNA from Enki's rib, which that's another thing, right? Like, Eve comes from Adam's rib. And it's crazy because the missing link in the evolutionary chain that led to Homo sapiens sapiens existing has not been found. You know, I ended up doing my minor as an undergraduate about biological anthropology, and that was one question that I had that I assumed that they would be able to answer, was like, okay, where did human beings come from? And they're like, well, there's a missing link. We don't really know. We know where everything else came from, but we don't know where humans came from. And then you find these oldest records, the oldest record in civilization about human beings being made from the DNA of extraterrestrials that are basically these gods, you know. They're like, they weren't gods with a big G. They were like lowercase gods to the Sumerians, right? Which is just crazy. I don't know what to make of it again. And it also matches up with the timeline, right? Like, human beings are thought to be somewhere around 250,000 years old. And that's the same timeline that Sitchin gives us naturally, right? But anyway, apparently 200,000 years ago, Enki had two new children who were called Adapa and Titi. And this is basically where the real Adam and Eve story comes into play. Because Adapa and Titi were able to reproduce on their own. And they gave birth to Cain and Abel. And Enki only praised Abel because of his ability to, produce agriculture. It was basically for his agricultural skill, and Cain killed him for this, and then Enki cursed Cain, and Cain was exiled from the Eden. And basically in the Anunnaki reading of the Bible, Enki and Enlil become the Lord of, you know, they become the Lord of the Bible. They become the benevolent and the malevolent God of the Old Testament. So when you start reading the Old Testament from the Anunnaki lens, it becomes a whole different story, because it's, you know, individuals conversing with the Lord and like getting instructions, and the Lord actually being there in Eden, and it can fill in for Enki. Which, again, I said that this was going to be controversial. I'm not subscribing to that as the truth with an uppercase T, but that's how Sitchin's theories basically go. And Adapa and Titi end up giving birth to another son named Seth. And Enoch ends up coming from this line. And if you read the Book of Enoch, that ties into all of this as well. Enoch and Adini give birth to Methuselah. And Methuselah and his spouse, Ednot, give birth to a son named Lumach. And at this point, Adapa's bloodline serves as the royalty. And then basically from 100,000 years ago to 30,000 years ago, the Anunnaki males start mating with the female earthlings. And in Genesis 6:4, it says that the sons of God came unto the daughters of men, and that there were giants in the earth in those days and after that. And according to Anunnaki theory, that's who these giants were. They were the Nephilim, and they're even called the Nephilim in the Bible. So the Nephilim are the Anunnaki, and they are these giants in the Bible. And the offspring of the Anunnaki, males and females, were called the Watchers. That's what they're called in the Book of Enoch. And then skip ahead to 490,000 BC. And at this point, Zarathustra, also known as Utnapishtim or Noah, is born. And he is the son of Enki and a female earthling. But the knowledge of his birth father is kept a secret, and he is raised by Lamech. And he's called Zarathustra because that means he of long, bright life days, and Utnapishtim, which means respite, because it was believed that his destiny would be to bring the earth to a respite from suffering. And then 38,000 BC is when Enlil becomes annoyed with the increase of humans. And at this point, the climate became more harsh. And he believed that the hardships were because of the unchecked promiscuity of the humans. And he plans to leave Earth and to return to Nibiru. And they also started realizing that while they are on Earth, their lifespans were accelerating. Remember, the one Shar is equal to 3,600 Earth years. But the Nephilim, basically, it was said that they could partake in a liquid that enabled long life, and on Earth it was not readily available. And a researcher named Lawrence Gardner, who I've researched, I've mentioned him in the past, he had this basically thing. He called it the Anunnaki Starfire, which was basically this secretion that would enhance the pituitary and pineal glands of an individual, and that like the people that came from the Anunnaki bloodline would be given this starfire. And so that plays into it also. But the scientists on Nibiru said that the Anunnaki couldn't return. And then at 13,000 years ago, the Anunnaki became aware that the next time that Nibiru was going to pass through Earth, an immense tidal wave might be triggered. And Anu suggests that they should get on space chariots so that they can safely ride this impending flood out. And, of course, we've got these flood myths from all over the world. It seems to have actually been a historical event, this cataclysmic flood. And according to this, it was because of the tidal wave that was triggered by Nibiru passing through. And Enlil, he ended up coercing the rest of the Anunnaki to not tell the Earthlings of the impending flood. But Enki does not want creation destroyed, and he told this to his son Zarathustra through a reed hut. And he told Noah / Zarathustra / Utnapishtim that he would find the information on how to build an ark on a tablet. And for 40 days, this flood lasted, and the boat apparently landed on Mount Ararat. And the archaeology seems to possibly, verify that claim, because if you look on Mount Ararat, there is some kind of giant protrusion coming out of it that looks like it could be an ark. And if you haven't seen that, I would suggest look up the pictures online for yourself, do some research, find out for yourself. And the people that lived, they offered a sacrificial lamb, and the sky chariots go to check it out because all of the people were supposed to be dead. And Enlil was furious, but it was at this point in time when Enki reveals that Noah is his own son. And this marks the end of the olden times. And then at 10,500 years ago, the Anunnaki end up going to Egypt. And it was here that Ningishzida designed the pyramids, and he would end up being the Egyptian Thoth, That's Ningxiet as also Thoth. And, you know, he is the god of alchemy and astrology and of science and math and medicine and knowledge. So those are all things that you would associate with the building of megalithic structures. And apparently the pyramids were used as markers for the spacecraft. And they also made the Sphinx with the face of Ningxiet. And that doesn't really hold up, I don't think, because I think that it's been kind of pretty well shown that the Sphinx actually used to be the face of a dog instead of a cat like it is now. And also, the Sphinx is way older than what mainstream archaeology will tell you. And that's basically because there's weather erosion that's around the Sphinx that is from, they say it's like 1,000 years nonstop of torrential rain on the Sphinx. And you can look up Robert Bouval and Robert Schock are the researchers, Graham Hancock also, that have you know, looked into that Sphinx dating, John Anthony West as well. So if you haven't learned about the Sphinx being older than it really is, there's another thing for you to look into. And it was around this time also that apparently they established a spaceport control center platform that was built on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. And then around 9700 BC, this is when Marduk's first son, Ra, divides dominion over Egypt between Osiris and Seth. So now we're going to start getting into Egyptian mythology, and it centers around Amun-Ra, who I'm pretty sure most of you will be familiar with. And Seth conspires to murder his brother to gain control over the lands. He poisoned Osiris. He set him into a coffin and put him to sea. Osiris's wife, Isis, went and tried to put all of his pieces back together, and she couldn't end up finding his phallus, which is why obelisks have been erected. That's literally Osiris's phallus. And after that, Horus is born. And at around 8970 BC, this is when the first pyramid war took place. And it was said that basically Seth and Horus had a battle in the air. And Seth ended up shooting Horus with a poison dart. And Ningxiet revives him. And then Horus shoots Seth, and the Anunnaki declare that Seth should be blind and heirless. So that was the end of the first pyramid war. And that then at 8670 BC is when the second pyramid war came around. And this is when Dumuzi, who was the youngest son of Enki, fell in love with Inanna, who was the granddaughter of Enlil. However, their marriage was ill-fated, and it led to war between Enki and Enlil's ancestors. And at this point, Marduk and his wife conspired to have her impregnated to cheat him. And this is because they think that Marduk would think that he raped her. And he ends up fleeing, and he slips on a river and drowns in a torrent. That was Dumuzi. But Ereshkigal suspected she suspected her of death, and she chained her. This is Inanna. She suspected Inanna of the death and ended up chaining her. And they found Inanna lifeless and reanimated her with the body of Dumuzi. And then Inanna ends up saying that Marduk should be held responsible for the death, but Enki refused. And at this point, Enki and Enlil's families were pit against one another. And to me, this sounds like a lot like the Mahabharata, which is one of the Hindu sacred texts, which is basically about a war between rival cousins. And the Bhagavad Gita is one of the portions of the Mahabharata that has gained immense fame, and rightfully so. It's one of my favorite spiritual texts. So definitely I would suggest reading the Bhagavad Gita as an aside, if you would like to. And then eventually Marduk became trapped inside of a chamber in the Great Pyramid, and he was trapped there. And they decided that Marduk was to be punished but not to be executed, and he would be sent to a place where no Anunnaki lived, which was South America. And then Anu decided that the Earthlings would be the inheritors of Earth, and that the leaders would be instructed in science and religion. And they split Earth into four regions. It was the Tigris and the Euphrates, the Nile Valley, the Indus Valley, and the Sinai Peninsula. And Marduk established his reign. He came back, apparently, and he established his reign at Babylon. And he instructed his followers to make the Tower of Babel. And Enlil ended up endeavoring to halt Marduk, and he confounded the language there at the Tower of Babel. And Marduk and his brother Ningirsita quarreled over which of them should serve as the lord of the second region, which was Egypt. And Ningirsita decided to leave, and he fled to South America, where he is known as the winged serpent Quetzalcoatl or Kukulcan. So that's another aspect of this whole story, is that basically all of these ancient civilizations were linked, and they were linked by the Anunnaki. And I think that this is basically the Atlantean civilization that was said to have existed, was this Anunnaki conglomerate, if that's true. Like, you know, if that was the case, if Atlantis was real, I think this had possibly something to do with it. And you can see how closely iconography is linked between, for example, the Egyptians and Mesoamerican civilizations, and how, I mean, obviously Sumeria and Egypt are very linked, but I think the jump from Africa to South America is pretty stupendous, as far as the similarities between a lot of the cosmology and the gods and stuff like that. So, and then at this time, in Egypt, the Anunnaki were the Netaru. And so the Netaru were those high gods of Egypt. Marduk was Ra, Enki is Ptah, and Ningirsita is Thoth. And Sitchinites think that the first pharaoh, Menes, was he had actually derived his rulership because of his Anunnaki blood. And then came around Abraham, who was the son of Terah, and he had descended from Shem, who was the son of Noah. So Abraham, according to this, also comes from the Anunnaki tradition. And Abraham is instructed to go to Canaan, and the Anunnaki traveled to Canaan to protect the sacred sites, and it was here that they built the place of the celestial chariots. And then Ishmael is born, and Isaac is born, and the Abrahamic covenant is made. And it's also very interesting to note, just like from a historical perspective, if you're taking the Abraham lineage as being true, not even in this case, but like to the Bible, you know, Ishmael and Isaac ended up being the progenitors of Judaism and Islam. So apparently those are both too linked because of Abraham. And Marduk, around this time, ends up moving to Sumer, and he establishes rule at Babylon. And Marduk was basically just super power hungry. So the Anunnaki held a council to stop Marduk from becoming a supreme god, and they wanted to destroy the place of the celestial chariots with nuclear weapons to cut off movement between Earth and Nibiru for Marduk. And in apparently 2024 BC, the nuclear weapons were used, and the place of the celestial chariots was destroyed, and an evil wind destroyed the Sumerian civilization. And it's also interesting to note that evidence for nuclear weapons has actually been found in India in the ancient times, it would seem. So, and that's really the only way possible. I don't think that, you know, I don't think that humans were using nuclear weapons that long ago. So that's a perplexing thing that also you can look into if you're curious. And at this point in time, only Abraham's bloodline lived on. Babylon was apparently spared, which that was something that I read that was contradicting, because apparently that's where the place of the celestial chariots was located. And that was the whole thing that they were trying to destroy. But what I read also said that Babylon was spared. So I don't know what to make of that either. And Enki decides to leave Earth, and he has a scribe write down the events, and that's these tablets. And there's a thing that's still, it's a very famous archaeological discovery, which is called the Sumerian King's List. And it says on this King's List that the kingship had been lowered from heaven. And on the Sumerian King's List, it's listed, there's five cities, and there are eight kings lasting 240,000 years before the flood. And, you know, that's just perplexing. What scholars say is that, oh, it was all just the same name that they were using for the king, but Sumerian civilization doesn't go back 240,000 years like that. So the Sumerian King's List is an enigma, for sure. Basically, at this point in time, 610 to 560 BC, the Anunnaki departed from the Nazca spaceport. That's where the stuff I was reading says they took off from. And, some people think that the Anunnaki bloodlines have still lived on, that they've infiltrated the rulership. Conspiracy theorists that think that, you know, reptilians have infiltrated the government and stuff like that. Definitely there's definitely a bloodline, bloodline that was instituted and that lasted from ancient times into the modern day, and that's the European royalty. Sitchinites will claim that they are from the Anunnaki line. Again, I don't necessarily think that's true. It's also very interesting to note that almost all of the U.S. presidents have been related to, like, one or two British kings. So, I'm not a bloodline expert. I don't know what the chances of that happening are. But that's troubling, for sure. The reality of the Anunnaki is up for grabs, I guess. I'm not going to say if they're real or not. I would tend to think that they're not. I think that they're just myth, probably. But I guess only time will tell. Perhaps hundreds of thousands of years from now, Nibiru will make its return. I don't really know where it is, supposedly, in its elliptical orbit. But perhaps one day we'll know. Well, that's all for today's show. I certainly believe that we are not alone in the universe and that life on other planets exists. Whether the Anunnaki are part of that cosmology is still up in the air, in my opinion. Beastlore is available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, and wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure to follow me on social media at USU Folklore on Twitter and at Archaic Futurism on Instagram. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.